Thank you very much. Tough act to follow. I'll try to keep the F-bombs to a minimum so that Ozzy can continue to hold the Sabre record. I've been attending Sabre conventions for more than 30 years, and yet this is the first time I've presented to the whole group. So thank you for coming and for choosing to be here instead of going somewhere else like eating lunch. So let's begin. When we think of organized baseball during the middle of the 20th century, we tend to focus our attention on how the sport was challenged and how it responded during the Great Depression and World War II. Gazing at the Depression, we often look at such developments as declining attendance, downward pressure on salaries, reluctance to lower ticket prices, contraction of the minor leagues, the advent of radio broadcasting, battles over farm systems and the minor league draft, and various innovations like the All-Star Game, the creation of the Hall of Fame, and the establishment of numerous postseason awards. If we turn our attention to World War II, we see FDR's green light letter, organized baseball's patriotic efforts to contribute to the war effort while simultaneously trying to keep players on the field and spectators in the stands. The impact of the military draft, the pronounced decline in the quality of play, restrictions on spring training and travel during the season, the change in the composition of the baseball itself because of rationing, and the annual debate over whether or not the federal government would cause the sport to shut down entirely. On the other hand, the decade and a half after World War II, I'm going to try to keep talking right into the mic there. The decade and a half after World War II has often been tagged, too often, by too many, as a time when not much happened. Not so. Wedged in between the unspeakable horrors of the war and the political and social upheavals of the 1960s, the years after 1945 were a time of profound change, affecting nearly every aspect of American life, including baseball. Think here of only three factors. First, the tremendous growth of the American population. The baby boom, us. Second, the movement of that population from the East and the North to the South and the West. And third, the decision by many families to move from cities to suburbs, where they created a new middle-class lifestyle fueled by a sturdy belief in the so-called American way of life and a robust faith in the so-called American dream. The immediate post-war years marked the beginning of a period of stunning economic growth and the rise of a coincident spirit of national optimism that historian James T. Patterson has called grand expectations. By the end of the 1940s, the United States was earning 42% of the world's income and producing half the world's manufacturing output. And that was only the start. Americans fully embraced the unparalleled joys of consumer consumption. They obliterated the distinction between need and want. And they dove into the purchase of housing, clothing, furniture, automobiles, liquor, and a wide array of household appliances nearly unimagined just a decade or so before. But these changes and this prosperity, for baseball at least, brought with them a new set of problems that deserve serious scrutiny. At the start of this period, organized baseball's executives looked to the future with unbounded optimism. Collectively, they seemed to express this opinion: the war is over. Let's get things back to the way they were. In a sense, they seemed to echo 1920 presidential candidate Warren Harding, who said after the end of the First World War, America's present need is not heroics, but healing. Not nostrums, but normalcy. How naive that embrace of a comfortable past proved to be. Baseball's outlook was wrong on two counts. On the one hand, I would argue that despite nostalgic memories of Babe Ruth, baseball had never really enjoyed a glorious past worth revisiting or resurrecting. Each decade, if that's how we choose to divide the past, had presented problems both unique and persistent. In addition, the immediate post-war years presented new challenges for which the powers that ran organized baseball were totally unprepared. The post-war years abide in certain recesses of American memory as a pleasant time. The Leave It to Beaver years, up one slide too many. White, straight, and middle class. But in truth, neither America as a whole nor baseball during these years should be so remembered. What I want to do today is present an overview of some of the issues baseball faced during these years and to reflect briefly on how ineptly baseball responded. None of this is particularly new, but I want to urge you to see these things through a new lens, an organic whole, often overlooked, that is decidedly not normalcy. First, manpower. What to do with returning veterans, with those who had left professional rosters to serve their country? The Selective Service Act, that is the draft, provided that anyone who served in the military during the war was guaranteed to recover their job after the war. Employers, said the law, quote, shall restore such person to such position or to a position of like seniority. And any person who is restored to such position shall not be discharged from that position without cause within 1 year after such restoration, unquote. How did baseball respond? As they had during the war, baseball owners thought themselves a special case. Ball players are not factory workers, they argued. They did not occupy places on an assembly line. Their skills were not interchangeable. Arguing that players of the game required talent, unique talent, and not just seniority, owners fashioned regulations they thought would satisfy the law. Each veteran who sought reinstatement would not be guaranteed a roster spot, but he would get a trial of either 30 days during spring training of 1946 or 15 days during the regular season to demonstrate if he still had the requisite skills. If so, he could occupy a spot on an expanded roster for a year. If not, he could be demoted to the minors or released. Yet not all teams respected their own rules, and two players sued, alleging unfair treatment. One was bought off by being offered a minor league contract with a major league salary. The second won his suit, and his club satisfied the judgment rendered in his favor. Second, labor relations. American workers organized into unions set a record for work stoppages in 1946, nearly 5,000 involving 4.6 million workers. Union leaders argued that wartime restrictions and post-war inflation justified substantial wage increases, enhanced fringe benefits, and better working conditions. Baseball players, especially those returning from the service, shared in this sense of dissatisfaction. Yet they had no vehicle to express or address their grievances. Watching baseball during this time of industrial strife was Robert Murphy, a Boston lawyer and labor relations professional. Beginning with the Pirates, resident in one of the country's most pro-union cities, he decided to offer major league players membership in the American Baseball Guild, a union he had just founded. Murphy's press release listed four basic objectives: freedom of contract, so that a player would not be forced to join a club against his will; the right to receive part of the purchase price if his contract were sold; the right to have disagreements about salary and other conditions of employment settled by collective bargaining and or arbitration; and fourth, the right to join a union. Nearly simultaneously, Mexican millionaire Jorge Pascal sought to entice American players to join his scheme to elevate the Mexican League outside organized baseball into the equivalent of a third major league, thereby bringing prestige to himself and to his country. After touring the United States in 1945 and getting a firsthand look at white American players and ballpark amenities he hoped to duplicate in Mexico, Pascal began to offer players contracts, some of them multi-year, at salaries far above what they were making in the majors. In all, he lured 23 major leaguers to Mexico in 1946, but it was his offers to players who turned him down that made the news. $300,000 to Bob Feller, $350,000 to Hal Newhouser, $360,000 to Hank Greenberg, all for three-year deals, and five $10,000 checks made out to Stan Musial just to put his name on a contract. How did baseball respond? In the case of Murphy's Guild, the owner of the Pirates, relying on inside information from an anti-union player, threatened the team, and the vote to strike on the afternoon of a night game failed. In the case of the Mexican League, Commissioner Happy Chandler slapped a five-year ban on those signing a contract with Pascal. And most players returned to the United States after a single season. More positively, owners agreed to let players elect player representatives who advocated successfully for the establishment of the pension plan. And yet, players' grievances persisted. And in 1953 came the birth of the Major League Baseball Players Associations, destined, as you know, to become one of the strongest unions in the country's history. Third, race. The history of how Branch Rickey and Jackie Robinson obliterated the color line needs no retelling here. True, Rickey and Robinson desegregated the National League in April 1947, and Bill Veeck and Larry Doby did the same in the American League a few months later. But what happened next? How did baseball respond? By dragging its feet. National League clubs integrated faster than American League clubs, but the final National League club to do so, the Phillies, did not put a black player on the field until April of 1957, 10 years later. And the final American League club to integrate, the Red Sox, did not do so until July of 1959. The minor leagues, too, moved with all deliberate speed. See what I did there? With one league centered in the South going out of business rather than submit to integration. Fourth, demographic change. As the population grew, got younger, moved, and abandoned city apartments for single-family houses built on squared-off, well-manicured green space, organized baseball remained an entertainment whose star attractions performed in just 10 cities. Only one of them, St. Louis, was located west of the Mississippi, and only two of them south of the Mason-Dixon line. Fans, potential fans, civic leaders, business leaders, politicians, clamored for the chance to watch Major League Baseball in person. But the sport prided itself on a hidebound map that hadn't changed since 1903. One might say that the sport's leaders faced four choices. One, do nothing. Two, move existing teams from the declining Northeast to the expanding South and West. Three, expand, that is, add more teams to the existing framework. Or four, create a third major league in virgin territory by elevating the Pacific Coast League, the minor's strongest and most glamorous operation, with teams in Washington, Oregon, and California, to a status equal to the American and National Leagues. How did baseball respond? Fitfully, at best, without any grand strategy. The two existing major leagues dismissed the pleas of the PCL. Each league allowed some of its teams to move, as you know, but haphazardly. Expansion, increasing the number of teams in each league from 8 to 10, did not come until the existing structure was threatened by the embryonic and visionary Continental League. And even then, each league acted independently of the other, stumbling around the bases, in Andy McHugh's words, and competing with one another instead of cooperating. Fifth, television. Baseball televised its first game in 1939. The World Series appeared on television for the first time in 1947, and the first national broadcasts occurred in 1951. My students used to ask me, "Dr. G, when did people buy TVs?" And my answer was, "As soon as they could." Their purchases helped to redefine leisure from community activity enjoyed in public space to individual or family activity enjoyed in the home. And as the number of television stations grew, they joined together to form networks that could show the same programming simultaneously across the continent, creating a national entertainment culture. How did baseball respond? With fear and hesitation, with uncertainty, with a lack of understanding and vision. 2 decades before, baseball executives had worried that radio would cut into attendance. And now they worry that broadcasting games on television would do the same thing. Yet teams did begin to televise their games, and the results were profound. As major league games began to be shown in minor league cities, owners' fears materialized, and the minor leagues nearly collapsed. But baseball moved slowly to understand television, to harness its power, and to devise a strategy that might augment the game's appeal instead of eroding it. There were other developments that today we don't have time to explore, but let's mention them briefly. Safer travel by air, old decrepit ballparks, problems signing young players more interested in going to college than playing in the minors, and the persistence of the peacetime selective service draft. Overriding all of these challenges was the fear of government intervention aimed at dealing in some fashion with the implications of the Supreme Court's 1922 decision that baseball was not interstate commerce and was therefore not subject to antitrust regulation. The House Judiciary Committee had created a subcommittee on study of monopoly power, chaired by Emanuel Seller, a Democratic congressman from Brooklyn, and this subcommittee soon had baseball in its crosshairs. In 1951, hearings focused on baseball for 2 days in July, 6 days in August, and 8 days in October. This was an enormous endeavor. Published testimony, including reams of financial data that baseball surely did not want made public, ran to 1,643 pages, and it was followed months later by a 232-page report. How did baseball respond? By approaching these hearings with fear. Fear about the decline of the minor leagues, fear about television, fear about expansion, fear about the reserve clause, and fear about the sport's antitrust status. Both Happy Chandler, by then the former commissioner, and Ford Frick, by then the new commissioner, both testified. So too did Ty Cobb, a bunch of other players, and a host of others, including Taylor Spink, Red Smith, and one senator who was also the president of a minor league. Baseball hardly spoke with one voice. Baseball managed to preserve its legal status quo, not because of any action on its part, but because Congress was not of one mind. Some members of Congress wanted to redefine baseball as interstate commerce and make it subject to antitrust regulation, while others wanted to enshrine baseball's special status in antitrust law. In the end, Congress did nothing. Organized baseball survived as, that was my big laugh line, I think. Congress did nothing. Organized baseball survived as it was, and the business of baseball continued to muddle through. Roger Kahn glorified these years as the era. Too many others have used the phrase golden age. They were not. Baseball struggled, it endured. It limped into the future, buffeted by all this turbulence. Has this short discussion of some of the issues confronting organized baseball in the immediate post-war years whetted your appetite for a fuller examination of this time period? If so, there's not an app for that, but there is a book. Its title is Baseball of the Turbulent Mid-Century Years, and it's just out from the University of Nebraska Press. I commend it to your attention. Thank you very much. We have 5 minutes left, so I can take your criticism. Yeah. Steve Treader.
Dr. Gitcher.
I'm gonna butter the bread here first. If you don't know Steve Treader, he's the author of the biography of Horace Stoneham. And if you don't buy my book next, buy his next. Okay, now your question, kind sir.
He didn't pay me at all. I didn't pay him at all for that. I assume your book covers this, but could you relate the tale of how Bill Veeck, the owner of the St. Louis Browns, was not allowed to move his team to Baltimore, how the American League owners handled getting the Browns to Baltimore?
Yes, well, you know, Veeck owned the Browns, and they were by that time the second class team in St. Louis. And you know all the stories, a total attendance 1 year of what, 78,000? The Cardinals get that on 2 days on a weekend now. Allegedly, once upon a time, someone called the Browns ticket office and said, what time is the game? And Veeck said, I don't know, what time can you make it? And he knew St. Louis was a losing proposition. He wanted to move the Browns first to Milwaukee, but Lou Perini had his, you know, there was a farm team there, but Perini had his eyes on Milwaukee, so that was disallowed. And then he wanted to move to Baltimore, as Steve indicates, and the American League, to simplify things, basically said, as the Sporting News said to me once, we're moving and you're not. And so the Browns moved to Baltimore and became the Orioles, and Bill Veeck was out of baseball for what, 5 years, 6 years, something like that, till he bought the White Sox for the first time. Yeah. Yes, sir.
Yes, Steve, that was an excellent presentation. This is a little bit off topic, but could you talk a little about the quality of baseball during the war when a lot of the players had gone off to war, but not all of them?
The quality of play on the field during the war.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know if anybody's quantified this in any meaningful way. I suppose people have, but I have not. You know, I think it's pretty clear as the stars and other players, lots of players, minor leaguers and major leaguers, went into the service, their replacements necessarily had to be ball players of lesser quality. And, you know, I don't want to pick on anyone, but when the Browns hire an outfielder who has only one arm and he does okay, that kind of gives you an indication of how the quality of play had declined.
Yes, I was wondering if you'd say a little more about television. My recollection is that in the late 40s and early 50s in New York, that area was saturated with television by all three teams. And then later on in 58, when O'Malley moved the Dodgers to L.A., he did not allow any home telecasts at all.
Well, that's true. When the Dodgers moved to Los Angeles, there were, I think, no home games televised. And the only games, Jim Walker's here somewhere, I think. The only games that shown in Los Angeles were the games being played against the Giants in San Francisco. Is that right? Yeah. You know, baseball thought that baseball on television would hurt baseball. They were wrong. Television hurt baseball. People didn't stay home from the ballpark to watch the Dodgers. They stayed home to watch Bishop Sheen and Milton Berle. Television was such a phenomenon. I mean, some of us are old enough to remember the first television set in the neighborhood and how other families would kind of invite themselves over at night to get a look at this new device. It's an incredible machine. It still has an effect on baseball, I would argue. I think, yeah. Okay. All right. Anyway, yes, sir.
Hey, good show, Steve. You're talking about this period as a period of decline for baseball, but the first couple of years after the war, baseball had its best attendance ever, yes. like set records that held for decades after that. And the minor leagues as well just kept growing. 1949 is still, you know, the year that had the most minor leagues and the most minor league teams. So can you talk a little bit about what the thinking was about baseball coming right out of the war before it went into your kind of decline phase?
I think the success that baseball enjoyed at the box office in 1946, 1947, and 1948 reinforced the owners' belief that they didn't have to do anything, that the game would be just fine. Mm-hmm. And in fact, those attendance records were longstanding. Boy, the Yankees went over 2 million, I think, in 1947. That didn't happen again until 1978, something like that. Mm-hmm. You know, but almost immediately thereafter, the bottom fell out. Right. Major leagues and the minor leagues went out of business. You know, minor leagues went out of business. Sure. Attendance. You know, if you look at total attendance over the 50s, you have to correct for Milwaukee and Baltimore and then Los Angeles and San Francisco. You look at the other teams, and it's almost a steady. We saw some graphs this morning, like the Cubs' fortunes down, and down a little bit more. Yeah, you know, but you know, baseball was succeeding. You know. If that's what you want, or declining despite itself, and the owners had no vision, you know. My good friend Dave Bomer, I don't think he's at the convention, would argue that Ford Frick was a great commissioner. I respectfully disagree, and I think Warren Giles as head of the National League and William Harridge and then Joe Cronin as the head of the American Leagues, you know, come into the office and if possible do nothing until lunchtime, you know. Yeah, yeah. Maxwell. No more time. Sorry. All right, I'll be in the book area. We can continue the conversation there. Thank you.